You're listening to 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, I'm going to share an interview with Suzanne O'Sullivan. Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan is the author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. It's a book about psychosomatic disease. In the second half of the show, we're going to air an interview from last spring with the author Anna Quindlen, whose new book at that time was Miller's Valley. It's still her most recent book. Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan has been a consultant in neurology since 2004, working first at the Royal London Hospital and currently as a consultant in clinical neurophysiology and neurology at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, as well as a specialist unit based at the Epilepsy Society. She has developed an expertise in working with patients with psychogenic disorders alongside her work with those suffering physical diseases such as epilepsy. Here's a little information about Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. In her clinic work as a trained neurologist and neurophysiologist, O'Sullivan was alarmed at the number of patients plagued by illnesses with no apparent physical origin, illnesses born not in the body but in the mind, through an episodic and absorbing collection of tales from just some of her brave patients. Is It All in Your Head? Takes us on an eye-opening journey through the very real world of psychosomatic disorders to reveal just how common these disorders are and how many cases go misdiagnosed. The book won the 2016 Wellcome Book Prize. It's her first book. When I spoke to Dr. O'Sullivan last week, I asked her to begin by talking about a statement that she makes in the book. Modern society likes the idea that we can think ourselves better. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
We hear an awful lot about what people have to say about the power of positive thinking on recovering from illness, mm-hmm. or the idea that if we kind of look after ourselves both psychologically and physically, that we can prevent us from getting sick. And I think that people really embrace that idea, and the reason they embrace it is because it's kind of empowering, and it says, you know, I'm a strong person and I can overcome this. But unfortunately then, when you try and look at this in the reverse way and say that occasionally the way we think about our bodies and the way we respond to our bodies can actually lead to illness, that people really struggle with that concept. And I'm not 100% sure why that is, but I do think that it's because it has connotations of weakness in the person. You know, that if we get sick for psychological reasons, I think we have a tendency to think that that means something related to that person's personality, that it's not just an illness. We can't regard psychological illness like other illnesses as just nothing more than a medical problem. You know, we insist on seeing them as related to a person's personality or as implying weakness. And I think that's a terrible shame because they're just medical problems. They're a way we respond to hardship.
Right. It's interesting. I sort of looked up the etymology of psychosomatic just to kind of, you know, reacquaint myself. And the word somatic by itself sort of indicates of the body, but particularly apart from the mind. And it's interesting that even the word seeks to separate the two.
Yeah. I mean, we actually, when it comes to how these disorders are labeled, I labeled them in the book as psychosomatic because I really wanted people to know exactly what I was talking about.
Right.
Because I think a lot of the labels are designed to kind of hide what we're talking about to make
yes.
it more acceptable by not naming it. So actually, more often, these disorders are just called somatic symptom disorders, and there's nothing in the name to imply where they might be coming from. But that's kind of frustrating because it's denying humanity exists, and it's denying the fact that sometimes when, you know, we think about our bodies in a certain way or we're stressed, it comes out as a physical symptom, and we've all had that, so why deny it?
Right. Now, you also use the word functional disorder or conversion disorder. What would the differences
yeah.
be, if any?
Well, really, they're really very much the same.
Okay.
So a functional neurological disorder is how neurologists now label this. So that's the official name for it. And really, when I was writing this book, if I had been sticking to all this sort of, you know, technical details as a neurology now sees them, I would refer to all of these as a functional neurological disorder. And I think that name is reasonable because all it's saying is your nervous system isn't functioning correctly. You've got a disability, but I'm not making any judgments as to why that is. But I think that label has problems in another way, which is that if, you know, you say to someone, I have a functional neurological disorder, they don't know what that means. It's kind of hiding the diagnosis in jargon. And what I would prefer that we do is that we all just accept that this exists and,
right,
and no longer have to hide it in jargon, you know?
Yeah. It's true. You know, as I read the book, I was struck by how much of your job is just getting people to accept that this is a thing.
Yeah.
And it seems like it would be so much easier if you could just explain it to them and they could say, oh, okay, so what now?
Precisely, because when you give people this diagnosis, very often at the end of a long conversation, which I will spend, you know, a lot of time explaining to them what is wrong and making sure that they don't feel it's pejorative, a lot of people at the end of it, of a conversation like that, will say, well, what you're really saying is that there's nothing wrong with me, or what you're really saying is you don't know what's wrong with me. That's precisely what I'm trying very, very hard to make people understand that I'm not saying.
Right.
This is a real condition. It's a medical condition. You know, small versions of this happen to us all the time. You know, if you get a flu injection and then you think that you get flu-like symptoms. Some people do, some people don't, but sometimes it's something that we sort of imagine because we're worried about it. So these sort of things happen to us all the time. They are real, and in extreme situations, you know, they can extend to disability. And I think if we could just accept this is a medical disorder, just like any other medical disorder, then we could move forward. And that would also promote research, that would promote interest in journals and conferences, rather than this current situation, which is that it's kind of a non-diagnosis rather than a diagnosis.
One thing that I found helpful in the book was when you distinguished between illness and disease. Can you maybe talk about that a little bit?
Disease is something pathological, meaning that we have something organically wrong with our body. And you can have a disease but not actually be ill at all. So somebody who has asthma under good control has a disease, but they don't feel ill. Illness, on the other hand, is our perception of how we feel.
Mm-hmm.
And we can be ill without disease. So, for example, at the end of a stressful day at work or a difficult period in our lives, we might develop something like headaches. Now, that doesn't imply that we have a disease, but we don't feel well and therefore we're ill. But I think we've got a real problem with this. Doctors in particular have a problem with this idea. Doctors need patients to complain about their symptoms in proportion to the disease that we find. But unfortunately, everyone's experience of their own bodies and their experience of disease is different, so people simply won't complain in proportion to disease that's found. I think we need to be much more understanding of that and much more sympathetic to people suffering out of proportion to what we have found on our medical investigations.
Sure, right. One important story in the book is that of Matthew. I'm assuming you've changed the names.
Mm, yeah.
You called him a product of the internet age, and he had decided he had MS, and he had used the internet to self-diagnose. And I thought that must be hard. I mean, maybe sometimes it's helpful because people come in with useful information that they've uncovered that will be of use to you. But sometimes it must be hard when people have just become quite firmly fixed on a disease they've found on the internet.
Yes, it is difficult, although I would say that I don't believe that the internet has really massively changed the situation for doctors where this condition is concerned. I think what's happened is that people come in now with a different language for the symptoms than they used to. So before the internet, if you got a series of symptoms that you couldn't explain, then you got your information from encyclopedias or your next-door neighbor or something in the news, and you attributed your symptoms based on that knowledge. Whereas now people attribute the symptoms based on a broader knowledge base and they use much more technical language and things. But I don't think it's really kind of made the problem an awful lot worse. It's just really changed how people think about their bodies. And I find that, you know, if you read about a disease in a book and then you go to your doctor with that disease, generally the story that you tell will not be the same as the story of someone who is actually suffering with that disease, because I think books are quite a poor representation of what it feels like to suffer with something. Mm-hmm. So I find that it doesn't make a huge amount of difference to a doctor's job, I don't think. But it can cause anxiety to people, on the other hand, you know, because now we just, you know, you type numbness in your feet into a computer and the number of scary answers that come up, you know, you can understand why people get very frightened.
Yes, absolutely. Although I was wondering how it is for you now that you know so much. Do you perhaps tend to discount when you're not feeling well, or is that just, that's too simplified?
No, I am the worst in the world for discounting my own symptoms. And I feel that, you know, it's a difficult one because, you know, it's very difficult to advise people when I can't even advise myself exactly how to approach every new symptom. The way I do approach it is I go to my doctor and I worry her about it and I tell her that I think I have a psychosomatic symptom, and then we end up in a difficult situation. So it is really, really hard to know how to respond to your own symptoms, and I'm no different than anybody else in that. And I try to wait things out, and if I can't wait them out, I go to my doctor, and sometimes she does tests that I think I don't need, but I've put her in a difficult situation by asking her to interpret my symptoms. So I think it's very, very difficult, but I think the key is that if you're worried about something, you go to your doctor, you get reassurance, and try and take the reassurance when it's given to you.
Right, yeah. Now, we've already talked a little bit about the tendency to dismiss patients who perhaps seem to have some sort of psychosomatic disease. And one aspect of the book had to do with family and friends and the way that family and friends treat people. And do you find that that will exacerbate symptoms, or people try to hide from their family? You know, how does that play out most of the time?
Yeah, I think the involvement of family and your kind of the people who immediately support you is incredibly important, because they're pivotal to how things change. You know, in a situation where you're really worried about your health and you're given this psychosomatic diagnosis, you know, when family and friends are able to support you through that, it really makes a difference in helping people by allowing them to know that they're not being judged for this, that everyone accepts it happens and it's just an illness. You know, there's two scenarios that I encounter, and one is that, you know, family and friends are really supportive of the diagnosis, and whether the diagnosis is right or wrong, ultimately it's really helpful to the person to have people just backing them up during it.
Right.
But sometimes I encounter a situation where, you know, people, they accept the diagnosis themselves, but then, you know, the family struggle to accept it because it can have wider connotations within a family. You know, it's not like getting diabetes. Diabetes is a pathological process that has nothing to do with anyone around you. Whereas these psychosomatic conditions may or may not be due to people around you, and people around you can sometimes therefore take this diagnosis as badly as the person themselves, and unfortunately that's very counterproductive for the person with the symptoms.
Yeah.
So I personally try to include family in every discussion, because I think it's really important that everyone knows what's being said, because if you just talk to the patient, they may go home to the family and the family haven't heard the full discussion and may not fully understand what's going on. So I think it's important that everybody's included.
Now, you're from the UK, you're Irish, and you practice in Dublin,
yeah.
Is that correct?
I practice in London, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry, in London. Okay. No, I was just going to ask if you've noticed differences in the way various countries accept or understand these disorders.
Yeah. It's speculative, you know, because obviously I can only really comment on my own experience in my own practice. I know that, you know, from studies that look at the rates of these disorders in lots of different countries, that it doesn't matter what sort of health service you have, this exists in similar amounts, no matter what economy you live in and no matter what sort of health service you have. And I can only really sort of have my own experience working for the National Health Service and also as a private neurologist in London to draw on. And from that experience, I would say that where a health service where the doctor is incentivized. So where you're in a position that you are earning more money the more often you see a patient, mm-hmm. where you're in a position where the more tests you do, the more money you're going to earn in this circumstance, and where angering a patient or upsetting them by giving them a diagnosis which they will find unpalatable drives them away, then that can have quite a detrimental effect on the doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah.
And I do fear that if someone's in a situation where giving a diagnosis of a psychosomatic disorder might alienate the patient or might result in a situation where there's less tests and less hospital visits, so it's very easy in that situation for a doctor to find themselves erring on the side of diagnosing disease rather than being brutally honest with the patient. So I value the NHS because I think it protects people in this circumstance because it's entirely unincentivized medicine where a doctor earns nothing and gains nothing from making a particular diagnosis, offering a particular treatment, or doing an MRI scan. Whereas in private medicine, in my private practice, I can see how easily that can go awry because it really affects the doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is, and you talk about this in the book, about the costs of healthcare. Everybody's always talking about the costs of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And you say that there's an estimated $256 billion cost associated with these disorders as opposed to $132 billion to treat diabetes in 2002. That was a staggering cost to me, and I assume that has to do with all of the work that's done to rule out other diagnoses before you get to this. Is that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what the money's going on, and that's what makes it so sad. That's not $256 billion spent trying to make someone better. That's $256 billion spent on doing an MRI scan, and when that's normal, doing another MRI scan, and when that's normal, going and seeing another specialist.
Right.
And none of those investigations are actually helping people. Those investigations are actually perpetuating the problem. So if we were to change the way we spent that money, if we considered a psychosomatic diagnosis at the beginning, and I don't mean dismissing a disease, you can do these things simultaneously in the same way that if I see somebody with chest pain, I'm thinking, well, is it a lung problem or a heart problem? You can consider these at the same time.
Right.
Well, why not say, is it a lung problem? Is it a heart problem? Is it a psychosomatic problem? Consider all of these at the beginning, and perhaps then you won't end up having 6 MRI scans and 3 specialists. Perhaps you can get there sooner and spend the money in a more sensible way.
Now, when it comes to something like chest pain, the diagnosis that we're familiar with as being called panic attack, is that, would you call that a psychosomatic disorder?
Well, I think panic attack is a little bit different because really in a panic attack, people are aware of the panic.
Mm.
So the difference really with a psychosomatic disorder is that, you know, people are worried. They're worried about their symptoms, but the thing that's really disabling them is the physical symptom, and often the anxiety or the worry or emotional feelings are the least of the problem. Whereas in a panic attack, someone is aware that they have this feeling of panic and fear and anxiety going along with it. So it's easier, therefore, for a person to recognize a panic attack as a panic attack because they feel the emotion. In psychosomatic disorders, maybe very little emotional upset going along with it.
Right. Okay. Just going to break in quickly to say you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and this is an interview with Suzanne O'Sullivan, author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness, a book about psychosomatic disease. We're streaming at 99.3wbtv.org, and actually the audio is about to get a bit better. I called her back because we had a not-so-great connection, so hopefully from here on out you'll enjoy listening a little bit more, but I hope you're enjoying anyway. I've always been interested in hypnosis, and you do in the book talk a bit about the history of treatment. And one of the things you talk about is the use of hypnosis and also sodium amytal. Is that basically like a truth serum?
Well, yes, it is like that. Yeah, it just anesthetizes someone just enough so that they're more suggestible and that they're more open to discussions, etc. So, yeah, hypnosis has been and actually still is used for this disorder. And, you know, I don't use it in my practice. And I think, you know, there are some ethical issues that go along with it because people are suggestible
right.
with drugs and with hypnosis. So it's, you know, that it really is, you need a careful practitioner to handle something like hypnosis. But that's not to say that I'm against it, because people have been helped by hypnosis in different ways. And they don't use sodium amytal so much now, but actually propofol, which is an anesthetic drug. So now, in some places in the UK, they give propofol at a very low dose, so it makes someone kind of relaxed and suggestible, but doesn't fully put them asleep.
Right.
And they can then help them to overcome their disabilities when they're in that suggestible state. And that actually has worked for people with extreme disabilities, but it is something that's used in a real extreme situation. And, you know, I think that, you know, there it has its place, hypnosis. I was actually recently hypnotized to my own absolute shock, to be honest, because I wasn't sure how I felt about it myself. And I was at a meeting with a bunch of neurologists, and a psychiatrist came to the meeting and said he would hypnotize us all. And there was a group of us, I guess 20 or 30 of us, and actually a very large number of people in the group were successfully hypnotized, even in that large kind of socially embarrassing kind of situation.
Okay, so everybody was hypnotized at once?
Yeah, basically they hypnotized the whole room. It was part of a research study that they were doing, and they had a variety of things, and they suggested at the end of this that once the hypnosis had been stopped, that they would tap the table twice and that we would then scratch our noses. And basically, we'd all been dehypnotized, or we believed the experiment was over. And the person who was doing it tapped the table twice, and approximately one-third of the room scratched their noses, much to my complete surprise. So after seeing that, I will believe almost anything, to be honest, because, you know, that was a skeptical bunch of people to hypnotize, and it was very successful.
Well, even if not skeptical, incredibly sophisticated as far as what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible, the power of mind in that situation. Very, you know, it was a very subtle hypnosis, and the power of the mind to kind of, to sort of influence your behavior without your knowledge is really astonishing.
Yeah. Now, two other diagnoses are the factitious and the malingering disorders. And I almost hate to bring them up because it sounds like it's a very small percentage of what you run across. But I did think that we should talk about them because they do exist. And it is what some people really assume is going on when people have psychosomatic illness. So can you maybe talk about the differences between these?
Yeah, I think it's an important point to raise, actually, because it is the exact assumption that people with psychosomatic disorders are worried about, that somebody is accusing them of faking. Mm. And actually, I think it's very rare. So in a factitious disorder, it's where somebody pretends to be ill and deliberately, with complete insight, fakes an illness in order to get a certain sort of attention, usually medical attention. And it used to be known as Munchausen's, but is now known as a factitious disorder. Mm. Now, the important thing about this is it's still a serious illness. So it tends to be portrayed as if somebody, the sufferer, is being manipulative in some way, and they are being manipulative, but they're being manipulative because the only way they know to get a certain sort of help or certain sort of attention is by being ill. Mm. And that is one of the most disabling things I've ever encountered. People with psychosomatic conditions very often get better, whereas people with factitious disorders very rarely get better. So it's a lifelong, kind of life-destroying condition. Mm. Malingering, on the other hand, is not an illness. Malingering is where one pretends to be ill for some sort of financial gain. So you're suing a large corporation, or you want to get long-term disability and never work again, for example.
Right.
And that, again, it's insightful and it's done deliberately. Although, again, I have to say, you know, I think there's shades and nuances of everything. Because, you know, I don't see malingering very often. But on the occasions that I have seen it, it's often in individuals who just, they've had terribly difficult lives and they don't know any different, or they don't know any better way of solving their problems. So it is illegal. It's not an illness. But there's a big difference between someone who's trying to avoid being sent back to a country where there's a huge amount of conflict, so they pretend to be ill,
right,
and somebody who's suing a large supermarket. So that has nuances too, I think.
Yeah. So let's talk about the danger of receiving inappropriate medical care. We talked already about ruling out other diagnoses, but sometimes instead of just ruling it out, people will go ahead and say, oh, they're having an epileptic seizure and we need to treat it that way. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think people really underestimate the harm of having unnecessary investigations. So MRI scans, for example, are incredibly sensitive. They can pick up irregularities in the brain that, you know, 20 years ago, before we had MRI scans, we didn't even know that we had. So people walk around quite happily with little cysts and things in their brains that they don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And then you have an MRI brain scan in order to kind of relieve your anxiety, and you discover you have a cyst, or even worse, you discover you have something like an abnormality in a blood vessel, for example. Unfortunately, once you discover these abnormalities, even though they might not have any relevance whatsoever to the symptoms that you have, then the doctor is obliged to pursue them in some way. So it really can be quite harmful to have tests that you don't need, and the same applies to a lot of tests. I think the problem really exists that a lot of our investigations have a kind of a gray area in them. So test results don't come back positive or negative. They come back as a certain value that is open to interpretation.
Yeah.
Within that interpretation, a lot of overnight diagnosis is done. So one of the investigations that I report very often are EEG or brainwave tests for epilepsy. Mm-hmm. They are hugely variable between individuals, and it is extremely easy to overdiagnose epilepsy on an EEG, and I've seen it done many, many times. And once a diagnosis has been made, somebody goes on treatment they don't need, and it's very difficult to kind of undo the diagnosis. And exactly the same exists for conditions like autoimmune conditions. A lot of doctors who don't regularly send away blood tests for autoantibody screens, when they do send them away, they get back a positive result and they think, oh, this person must have an autoimmune condition. But actually, there's an awful lot of false positives, false negatives. There's an awful lot left open to interpretation, those sort of blood tests also. So the overdiagnosis rate in those conditions is also very high and can lead to some really toxic treatments. So I think, you know, most doctors would actually think twice before they have some of the tests that they send their patients for.
Yeah.
Because we're aware of the overdiagnosis rate. I think the general public needs to be aware of it also.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the likelihood of recovery or improvement. If a patient accepts the idea that perhaps they have a conversion disorder, are they more likely to have improvement? And how often do you see recovery?
Well, at the moment, the recovery rate in most studies is actually quite low. But actually, the reason for that is because there are very poorly developed services for this. And it's likely the recovery rate would be a lot higher if we actually dealt with it better.
Right.
There is lots of evidence that if you just discuss these conditions with people in a compassionate way and make them understand what's happening, that a certain percentage of people will get better spontaneously. Mm-hmm. Also, there's studies that show that even if someone's been really disabled for quite a long time, they are totally amenable to treatment. So just to give you an example, as neurologists, we used to think that if somebody had a functional weakness in their legs for a few years and they'd been in a wheelchair for a few years, that there was nothing could be done, that you'd kind of miss the boat, and the earlier you treated people, the better it was. Mm-hmm. But recently, a physiotherapist did a study in which he gave a 5-day course of physiotherapy to people who'd been wheelchair-bound for as long as 5 years. And in that 5 days, he was able to get people up and walking, now not in some miraculous way where they'd made a full recovery, but they showed an immediate amenability to treatment when they were given the correct treatment. So these are absolutely treatable disorders. There's a very low recovery rate, but that's because we're not treating them.
And are there people like you working in this field everywhere, or is it still fairly new and growing?
Well, it's still new and growing. There is a special interest group in the UK which has people from all over the world. So there's no doubt at all that this is something people really are waking up to. Uh-huh. And if you look at neurology conferences, for example, so 10 years ago, even though 1/5 of people who go to an epilepsy clinic actually have dissociative or psychosomatic seizures, if you went to a conference or picked up an epilepsy journal, you would not see this subject discussed at all. Wow. That is actually changing, and it's only changed in the last 5 years. Now, if you go to the American Epilepsy Society, which is one of the biggest epilepsy conferences, they will have a whole section on this, whereas that was not the case a few years ago. So it's really in its infancy, but I think neurologists in particular are really beginning to realize that we need to be taking more responsibility for this. I think we've always known it was a problem, but in the past we thought it was somebody else's problem. But I think that's finally changing all over the world.
And your book, how is it being received in the medical community?
It's been really heartening, and I think it's because, you know, this is our bread and butter of our work. You know, when you get up in the morning and go into your clinic and see however many patients you have to see, whatever your specialty is, you're going to be seeing a reasonable proportion of people who have lots of medical complaints that you just can't explain with disease. And we're not trained to know what to do about that. So we're all a bit out of our depth, and some of us are better at it than others. And I think the doctors are just delighted that someone is actually raising the subject. So actually the medical community has been really embracing of it.
Great. That kind of leads naturally into a question I have that's more of a kind of craft question as far as writing the book goes. How did you decide to write a book that I would call maybe a little bit more narrative nonfiction rather than a strictly academic book? Your book tells stories. It's really written so that a lay audience can understand it and appreciate it. How did you make that decision?
I think that the decision was really sort of innate. I mean, I'm interested in people, I'm interested in their behavior, but I'm also interested in writing. So I'm interested in reading stories, and I'm interested in writing stories that have nothing to do with my work at all. So when it came to kind of addressing this problem, then I think that telling it through patient stories was the only way that I felt that it could be told, because that's how I've learned from my patients. I didn't understand any of this beforehand, and I didn't know what to do when I encountered these patients. And I learned by encountering people, getting it wrong sometimes, having people recount their experiences to me, and for me to see how I could affect their experiences. And that's really how I learned, and therefore it was kind of the only way that I really could kind of move things forward. But also I'm unconvinced about the power of scientific research to change this at the moment, because there is a large body of scientific research at the moment that is looking at this situation, but it's not filtering through to the general public. And I don't think if it's presented as functional disorders and dissociative disorders and other technical terms that it will filter through. So I think there was really only one way for the story to be told.
Okay. In thinking about how you wrote this book, I'm curious if there were any particular challenges. You know, I'm noticing you're pulling together years of information and your own, you know, your own history as a physician. You had to organize it and protect patient confidentiality. So is there any particular challenge that comes to mind in thinking about how the book came together?
Yeah, really the challenge was in what to tell and what not to tell in terms of patients' personal stories, because I found that the confidentiality issue is extremely difficult, because when you ask people if you can tell their story, a surprising number of people say, you know, I want you to tell it just how it was. And I will say, well, you know, I think we should leave this bit out because it's too identifying, or it's too personal, or I think it's too much of the story to tell. And usually patients will say, no, I want you to leave that bit in. But, you know, I'm their doctor and it's my responsibility to protect them. And, you know, the way you feel in a moment that you don't mind telling something is one thing, but how will you feel about it a few years down the line when you see something that's written down and can't be taken away? Also, there's really an issue with families as well that meant I had to leave a lot of information out that, you know, could have added something to the stories, but I'm not just protecting the identity of the patients, but also the reactions of the people around them,
right,
and so on. So it really was, you know, it was really a very delicate situation about what to tell and what not to tell and so forth.
And then were there stories that you found you had to cut that you really wanted to keep in but that just didn't serve the book ultimately?
Well, I think more than not serving the book, there were things that I think could have served the larger story, but there are too identifying to the individuals and too sensitive. So in a way, sort of perhaps if I were to write some of these stories in a fictional way, you know, I could have kind of told a lot more. But my first responsibility is as a doctor rather than a writer when writing nonfiction in this way. So I think that anything that was left out really to protect the individuals and probably hurt the book rather than helping it. But that was the priority, really, was to protect the people involved.
Sure. Are you working on a new book at this point?
Yes, I am working on another nonfiction medical book about my patients once again. it's actually about the brain, and it's told through the kind of stories of my patients with epilepsy, because, you know, they really have absolutely extraordinary lives and they overcome extraordinary things. So I think they have a lot of things to teach people also.
Yeah, okay. What do you like to read apart from, you know, the medical journals?
Yeah, well, I much prefer reading fiction than medical journals, I should say. I absolutely love reading fiction. I came to this book actually through writing fiction, not through a desire to write nonfiction.
Oh, interesting.
I think it's, you know, it's an escapist thing, isn't it? You know, you don't want to go home and read lots of popular science books if your whole life is working in popular science, essentially. So I love writing and reading fiction more than anything. But, you know, then I realized the power of stories is unbelievable. So writing nonfiction has turned out to be incredibly powerful, and that's been really interesting for me.
Yeah. I would say, too, though, that reading good fiction, we can find, it's not always escapist, you know, I mean, I think we can find truths that that appeal to us in fiction, or that make our lives make sense. Does that?
Well, I mean, you know, the question arises, I mean, when is fiction actually fiction? And,
right.
You know, I see an awful lot of parallels between writing fiction and having a psychosomatic disorder in a way. I was at a meeting, or I was at a talk about the book, and a woman put her hand up and said that she's a writer, and she came to this subject as a writer, and she'd written one book about someone with a psychiatric problem, and she'd written a second book about a psychiatrist. And of course I immediately think, well, that's interesting. I mean, why did you write that? I mean, I don't think that your ideas for writing fiction come from fresh air any more than I think the symptoms we get in the face of stress come from fresh air. So I think it's strange. There's strange parallels there.
Yeah, yeah. So have you read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners as far as either fiction or nonfiction?
I have just finished reading Maggie O'Farrell's book, This Must Be the Place, which has absolutely nothing at all to do with psychosomatic illness.
That's okay.
I would highly recommend it because I couldn't wait to get to the end of it. I thought it was absolutely wonderful.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, now this is just kind of like not specifically to do with your book, but I have a question that I think maybe pertains to psychosomatic disease, and that is, what is going on with, mostly I think it's young women, but maybe young women and young men, at these concerts? You know, the pictures, all the old films of the Beatles concerts, and they are going completely nuts, and then they pass out, and they have to be carried out by the police. Is that similar to what we're talking about?
Well, you know what? It's not unrelated. And I'm actually in South America at the moment for a literary festival, and I've been asked the same question several times by journalists here, because there was an episode in Colombia where a group of schoolgirls in a single school all reacted by having repeated fainting attacks following an immunization program.
Mm.
That's not that unusual story, and it's not unrelated to this sort of mass fainting at rock concerts and so forth, which is that when we see people responding in a particular way, be it to something positive or be it to something negative, that sort of creates an idea in our heads of what is normal, what is the correct way to respond to this particular situation, and it's contagious. So there have been lots of outbreaks throughout the world of mass fainting episodes and other sorts of symptoms just based on suggestion. So of course people faint at rock concerts because it's too hot,
yeah,
and therefore they faint. But then that's not the only reason. They also behave in that way sometimes because the idea is there. This is how you show excitement, and this is what happened to my friend, and therefore it could happen to me, and then it does.
And it's probably related to the same reactions of the young women who were part of the Salem witch story. I would
yeah,
imagine, you know, just like the power of suggestion, as you say. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Dr. O'Sullivan, I just have one last question for you. And I'm just wondering if you have suggestions or ideas about how public perception becomes changed, even doctors' perceptions, about this diagnosis and about acceptance and moving forward so that it can be more of a positive step toward cure and recovery.
Yeah, I think the first thing really needs to happen is we need to just start viewing this as a medical disorder like any other one. So it's not a judgment on your personality or a statement about the kind of person you are. It's just something that happened to you that requires intervention so that you can get better. Mm-hmm. And I think that more than anything, that needs to start in medical schools. I'm really passionate about the idea that if we taught doctors to treat this in a different sort of way, that everything would change. So in average medical school now, you know, if somebody's taught about something like chest pain or memory loss, the possibility that the cause is psychosomatic isn't even raised in most cases, even though that's a really common cause of either of those two things, headaches or memory loss. It's left over as a thing we call kind of a diagnosis of exclusion or kind of a wastebasket in which we throw things when we can't find anything else. I think if medical students were taught to respect the disorder and therefore respect the people who had it, that would go a long way to changing things.
All right. Great. Thank you. That's a wonderful answer. I'm going to just mention again, the name of the book is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness by Suzanne O'Sullivan, MD, and it's published by The Other Press. Thank you so much for spending time with me talking about this. It's fascinating.
Thanks for your interest. I greatly appreciate it.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness, published by The Other Press. Today, the show is streaming, as every week, at 99.3wbtv.org. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about trying to convince someone of something important that for whatever reason is deemed implausible. I'll say that again. Trying to convince someone of something important that is for whatever reason deemed implausible. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. So I just want to let you know you can share this show. Let your friends know that it's a podcast. It exists on iTunes, but also at the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook. We are at Write the Book. It's just Write the Book, all one word. My website is shelaughswithoutus.com. You can also connect to the show there. We stream live, as I've been saying, at 99.3wbtv.org, Mondays from 3 to 5. And so what's happening every week is from 3 to 4, there's a new interview, pre-recorded usually, but new interview with an author or a poet or an agent or an editor or somebody who has something to do with books. And then from 4 to 5, there will be other content, either a rerun with another interview from the past, or sometimes I talk to owners of bookstores or librarians about what books they're recommending lately. We'll see what that second hour is going to hold. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, news about book events, or if you have suggestions about what I could do in that second hour that you think would be really interesting, send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And you can also rate the show in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends, please. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you have a great week.